From the home of the codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to the November 2016 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast, everything but the work. This month we take you back to the party that started the campaign to save the site where codebreaking was carried out during World War II. It was quite a party. It was sneakily planned, and those who organised it ended up feeling they'd got away with something. We'll delve into memories shared by the veterans that day, of fun, food and friendships, as well as a few dances and dalliances. It's worth a reminder here that that party was carefully timed to coincide with the 50th anniversary of the letter sent to Churchill asking for more resources. Sent in 1941, it opened the door for Bletchley Park to expand at a rapid pace to meet the ever-increasing demand. It was a real turning point. Before we go back in time to that momentous day in October 1991, we can spend a bit longer with some of the hardy annuals who turned out to this year's Veterans Reunion. It's always a great day, and once people start sharing their memories, it's amazing how much comes flooding back. Am I much mistaken, or is that Dr. David Kenyon, Bletchley Park's official research historian, that I spy, weaving in among veterans? Have you been meeting lots of people today?
I have, yes.
Is it a great opportunity, or do you find that there's just too much sort of busy having a day out? Do you grill people, drill them for information, or just file away ideas for later?
Kind of file away stuff. I just spoke to a bomb operator just then, and it's not the time really to start grilling her about her memories. She's here to have a relaxing day, and just nice to say hello to her. But nonetheless, having spent the whole of last year reading about bomb machines, just to meet somebody, even casually, who was involved with it, is really nice. And because I know quite a lot of the story, I was able to ask her one or two specific questions. For example, where she trained. She trained at Tullochewan Castle in Scotland, which is one of the places that people aren't so familiar with. And she was having a bit of a laugh about how many floors she scrubbed up there, which isn't really a very good qualification for operating a bomb, but that's
I've heard that before, though, that they must have spotted something about them, that they were being watched and monitored, and who knows what they were looking for, really.
I think they just made their lives miserable, and the ones who survived it were recruited.
Yeah, they take it, yeah. Are they made of stronger stuff? Maybe that was it.
My name is Mary Heal, H-E-A-L. I was 17 when I joined up and was stationed at Chick Sands, which was Y service, and it was a listing in station for Bletchley, because we had no idea that what we were doing was so important to the war effort.
I've heard it was really quite a boring job.
Yes, because it was, wasn't a wireless operator. I was the next cog in the wheel. The teleprinter Morse slip reader. I could read the Morse off messages and transcribe it into plain language and onto the printer.
Okay.
When the messages were coming out on ticket.
You had to concentrate to quite a degree to get the accuracy.
The concentration was immense. The fact that it was an all-out war effort, you know, there wasn't a moment of the day or night from the start of the war that those messages were being... enemy wireless messages were being intercepted. We worked a week of days, 8 to 4, and 4 to midnight, a week of evenings, and a week of nights, 12 to 8 in the morning. And the work, we were kept fully occupied for the whole 8 hours we were on duty.
Quite hard going.
Yes, yes. Time was off the utter input, not a moment had to be lost.
It's probably a good thing that you're all as young as you were.
Oh, yes,
that level
well,
of
that's
concentration.
True. To give you an indication how concentrated the work was, that every 3 months or so, the RAF had a beautiful large house in the next village, and we were given leave there for a week every 3 months or so, just to take the pressure off. But yes, we accepted it, you know, as I said, we had no idea how important it was.
When did you find out how it had
30 years later, when Bletchley opened its doors and windows.
Did it come as a shock to find out how
Well, we're amazed. I mean, I wear this today in memory of my late husband because he was an air crew. He had been a navigator in Lancasters. He was shot down, taken prisoner, rescued by the Americans, brought back to this country, made well again, but never flew again. But he became a code and cipher officer and came down to Chicksands. He was actually at GCHQ, but he came down to Chicksands to see what we were up to. And I got my eye on him. And we were married 3 years later. He was a lovely man.
Oh, good
I miss
for you.
Him still.
My parents met in the Air Force.
Did they?
Yes.
Yes.
At Wittering.
Oh, yes.
We always had to salute when we drove past it.
Yes.
So you must have discovered with your husband then sort of the importance of what you'd done and...
Oh, yeah, so very proud of being part of it. A very small cog, I may say, in the bigger wheel. But yes, oh, yes, absolutely.
And we keep finding out more as the years pass as to how many cogs there were in these wheels and just how big an operation
it was. Oh, yeah, well,
yes,
that is true, yes. Yes, because I was 17 when I joined up and I'm coming up to the big 9-0.
Good for you. I hope you have a big party. I see you've bought a brick in the Codebreakers Wall.
Yes, yes, yes. I've just been in. I've seen it and my husband's alongside of me. Yes, that too. I'm very proud to be up on the wall.
That must be quite special to have.
It was.
His name
it
there
is.
Too.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
Well, good for you. Thank
yes.
you very much
yes.
for your time. You enjoy your day.
Thank you.
What's your name, first of all? Now, I know, but it's for the tape.
Cicely Pickering.
And was it Pickering during the war, or is that your name?
It was Anderson.
Anderson. And what did you do?
I was on the bombs at Stanmore and at Eastcote.
Was that towards the end of the war, when there were lots and lots of bombs?
Yes. Oh, yes, yes. Well, I didn't go in until 1944. So
weren't old enough, I shouldn't think, were
you? I was just old enough, yes.
But not until 1944?
No,
yeah.
No.
So what was it like? What are your memories of that time?
Oh, I thoroughly enjoyed it.
I can tell from your tone that you've heard that lots of your colleagues didn't enjoy it so much.
Really?
Well, that it was hard. It was, you know, the shifts were very grueling, I've heard.
And I never found it particularly hard, I don't think. And, I quite enjoyed it.
It That's got youth for you.
Well, yes. And, it was smelly and... But you got good time off, you see, in between. So that was very good. And you had time off during the day. With the shifts, you could get up to London and that. And actually, where I was, I could actually get home from...
Where was home?
So, well, home was at Totteridge. And so from both Eastcote and Stanmore, I could get home by bus from one of them.
Considering you could have been posted to any corner of the world, really, with the Navy, couldn't you?
That's right, yes.
So fast forward, say, 30 years, when you found out, you know, how the whole thing fitted together, what was that like? I know that as bomb operators, you perhaps had slightly more privileged information than many who were cogs in the machine, because you would be told, I understand.
We knew what I was going to say. I would say we knew what we were doing.
And how important it was.
And yes, and every now and again, somebody would come down from the Admiralty, give us a little pep talk and tell us something that had happened that was sort of thanks to us.
The effect
you know.
You'd had, yeah.
So, we did know. We knew what the effect of, what effect sort of we were having. And yes, we'd got quite a good idea, which is why it's so amazing that it kept... That you know, it never got out.
So when it did start to come out, that must have been quite shocking for you.
Well, it didn't. It was surprising. I mean, it wasn't until the 70s, I think, that I actually told my husband what I'd been doing. You know, no, you just sort of.
How did he take it?
Didn't think all that much of it, sort of thing.
What did he do during the war?
Oh, he was the lovely hair on. It was intriguing, really, the way it didn't come out. All the everybody knew, and it was all sort of talk about what was going on. Because when I was at Eastcote and that, sort of what was going on in what was a populated area, you know.
What's it like to come back now after all these years? I know that you weren't stationed here, but obviously this is where it's all celebrated and told.
Well, I've never bothered about coming back before, but my daughter saw the invitation and she was keen to come and see it all. But yes, it's interesting, and interesting as far as I'm concerned, because although I came here, I didn't stay very long because I just got married and it was the end of the war. And they said, well, what do you want to do? Will you be staying or will you go? And I said, oh, I'll be going. So I didn't stay very long here. I didn't really get to know Bletchley Park at all.
Was it your idea to have a brick in the wall with your name on, or was that your family?
Well, I sort of, my daughter saw it and said, oh, yes, oh, you must do that.
You're under instruction. How does it feel now you see it?
Oh, yes, it's very nice, actually. And it's interesting, yes, looking up there. But the funny thing is, you don't remember names, or very few of them. And I'm going to be interested to see if I do remember any of them.
Well, enjoy your day. Thank you very much for sharing your thoughts.
Thank you.
I'm Nancy Pumphrey, formerly Clark. When I joined up into the Rents, I had always hoped I might get a posting by the sea. And I was put into a coach with others, and we were told we were not to talk to each other, and we would be going on a ride to another department. And we set off. Well, of course, I knew the area because my father had done farming, and Bletchley had always had a big cattle market once a year. So I thought to myself, well, I know there. To Bletchley anyway.
You were probably the only person on the coach you did know.
Well, we were told on no account talk to each other. And so into the park we went, and we were taken into a room where we stood before two people, and one was that would we be prepared to work and not talk about it? Would we promise? And I said yes. And the next person said, will you please swear on the Bible?
Oh, really?
And so, yes, I swore on the Bible that I would not speak. And after the war, after about 30 years, someone wrote a book, and a lot of people came up to me and said, you were in Bren, you were at Bletchley Park. And I said, but I took an oath.
Yes.
You've got plenty to read about. I shall not tell you anything. But, well, I'm now 96.
Well, you look very good for 96.
And once or twice to very special friends, I did say, well, you should go to Bletchley Park and see Hut 11, because that's where I was.
So Hut 11, you were a bomb operator then?
Yes, that's right.
So all and the stinky oil and the noise?
Oh, before we came out, we went through a curtain and we washed our hands and fingers with brushes, and then we showed them to an officer and she inspected them. Then she opened the door and we walked out into the hall, and then we went, if we were off duty, to a meal or whatever we were up to for the next time, whether we were free for 8 hours or whether we were going to lunch or, you know.
Oh, that's brilliant. I've never been told about washing your hands as you came out.
Oh, my goodness, with the brush. Well, because all that grease and stuff off the bomb that you were plugging onto the wall, you had a map, you see,
yes,
and you worked to the map. And sometimes the bristles crossed, and that caused a short.
And you had to have tweezers, didn't you?
Yes, I think.
To pull them out.
Yes, I also think I used my fingers.
Oh, really?
I think we all did, anyway, or we sort of felt to see if it was. But, yes, and then there were some gentlemen who were in the RAF.
Yes.
And if we had problems, we could speak to someone, an officer at the door, and say, please, may I have help?
We've actually got one of those gentlemen here today. There's a chap called Eric Hume, and he used to drive around here and Eastcote and Stanmore, wherever the bombs were. And he came and fixed the bombs.
Yes.
We'll have to find him for you sometime today, and you can tell him whether he did a good job when he was fixing the bombs or not.
Well, he did, whoever it was.
And so today you've got to see the Codebreakers Wall for the first time.
Yes.
So your name is now going to be here for forever, basically. How does that make you feel?
Well, I won't need a gravestone, will I? That'll be there for them to come and see. It'll be a cheap do for them, won't it?
Nancy, you're fantastic. But do you feel proud? Because you should do.
Well, it was for the King and the Queen.
Yes.
And my country.
Exactly.
And I had a boyfriend, and at that time, boyfriend, and he was in France. And I thought, well, I think I'll join up too. I had worked for years and years on the railway, on the LMS.
Mm.
And so I asked for permission to join up, and I was given permission. And that's where I ended.
Well, I just want to say thank you for your service to your country, Nancy.
Well, thank you
so much.
Thank you indeed. May I shake your hand?
Oh, no, it's my pleasure to shake yours.
Thank you.
Now, are you daughters?
Yes.
Both of you?
Yes.
Linda, the elder, and Priscilla.
Are you proud of your mum? You obviously are.
Yes. Yes.
Knowing her name will be on that wall forever, really.
Yes. It's a good feeling, yeah.
Yeah.
But we didn't know much about her work here.
No, she never...
Very recent years, because
she
wouldn't speak about it.
She was doing her service, and like a number of veterans, I mean, Nancy's not alone. We have ladies who don't want to talk about the work they did. They're happy to say that they were here. But, you know, they signed the Official Secrets Act, and as far as they're concerned, as Nancy just said, you did that for the King, didn't you?
I think it was because my mother swore on the Bible.
Yes.
That was the main... was more important to her than the Official Secrets Act, wasn't it?
Well, yes.
Really?
It was.
You know, I thanked her just now for her service, but her service has continued, really, because she's kept that secret, not just for the 30 years she could, or, you know, since the letter... told them all they could talk about it. She's still keeping that secret now.
She never even told our father. And he was, as I say, he was a Royal Engineer.
Mm. He was the one in France.
He was the one in France, the boyfriend.
Yeah.
But
she
wouldn't even tell him. He didn't know what she had done, did he? He had no idea what you did during the war.
No.
Wouldn't speak about it, just that she was a Wren.
I told him to go on open day and read a book.
It's beginning to look a lot like a 1940s Christmas at Bletchley Park. This year, a new recruit to the code-breaking effort will come all the way from Lapland and hold top-secret meetings with children in his grotto in the mansion. There'll be festive 40s decorations throughout the park, and you can book a Christmassy afternoon tea from the 3rd of December until New Year's Eve. It was meant to be a fond farewell before some battered and borderline derelict buildings were bulldozed to make way for housing, a supermarket and a petrol station. But the party held in October 1991 was a far greater success than any of the well-meaning locals who were involved in its planning could have anticipated. Veterans of the Government Code and Cipher School gathered for the first time in nearly 50 years to take one last look at the place where they carried out their top-secret, all-important war work. But a lot of their reminiscences that day were not about the work at all.
Bletchley Station! Bletchley Station!
The party took place. It was a roaring success. I got all the press and had all of them in here and interviewed them. Now, what really made me determine this park was going to be saved was one small incident. I was walking around the park with these two men I didn't know from Adam. One was Harry Hinsley, and the other one was a chap called Stuart Milderberry, who was the head of Hut 6. So you had the Harry Hinsley, of course, the art foreman, also this became number two here, and also wrote the great his magnum opus, British Intelligence in the Second World War. He, in fact, was talking with Stuart Milderberry and also with Edward Thomas, and they were walking down the lake, and I was walking with them. And they got round to where the steps are, and Stuart Milderberry said, "Do you remember, Harry, when you came in roaring drunk and drove your cycle into the lake?" Because Harry, of course, was really sort of a straight-laced bloke. Harry said, "Yes," he said. "And do you remember what you said?" Harry said, "No." He said, Stuart said, "Please don't tell Hillary. Please don't tell Hillary." Because, you see, Hillary was his girlfriend. He married her afterwards. But she also was a very quiet lady. And the thought of this chap she was going to marry, sort of wobbling up to the lake and probably falling in with his bike. And I thought, yes, that's the sort of thing we need. Not just the straight-laced stuff of the code breaking. These were normal, ordinary people doing an extraordinary job. That's the story I wanted to get. So that's what really kicked the whole thing going, made us determined, or me determined, this site really was going to be saved. So that's how the whole thing took off after the party. I suppose I could sum it up very briefly. It was uphill all the way. It really was, because we didn't have a penny. I mean, we had about £3.50 between us. So first of all, of course, we had nowhere to operate from. So we had permission to use the bungalow. We had about 10 of us crammed into there, and we had one small Amstrad computer, and which we had to boot up every time with floppies and that. And we had nothing else at all. That rest of the bungalow was empty. That's all we had. And so what we've got to do now is to try and get some money. So therefore, what we need to do is to have guided tours. But to get guided tours, A, you've got to get the guides, and B, you've got to have the information. So therefore, you've got to scratch around and get the information. As I said, British intelligence in the Second World War is a very good source of information, but it's very comprehensive. It covers all spheres, and you've got to work your way through it to get the essential bits. One of the chaps, in fact, who came along later on after the party was a chap called Ted Ediver. And he, in fact, wrote the first guidebook to Bletchley Park. That means to say we could now sell a guidebook to the park, and we could now get guides to tell the story to the park. That meant that people were coming in, so therefore money was beginning to dribble, and I do mean dribble in. And so having got some of the money in, we could now start doing other things. Well, my wife and Sue Jarvis, they started cutting up sandwiches and selling them. And then in late 1994, yes, Jack Darra and his wife turned up. Jack's wife, Rita, said, I tell you what, said, I'll bake cake. So she baked two very big and cream sponges, gorgeous they were. So we served them, in fact, from the naffy. And so that's how it all started, and gradually from there on. But it was uphill all the way. But we made it. That's it, basically. I still can't believe it. Well, I look behind me at those huts and see what they're like now, and see B Block, and see the way the garden's going. The tennis courts are being repainted, this, that, and the other. I can't believe it happened, because honestly, in the beginning, I thought maybe we were throwing snowballs at the moon. I really did. I never thought we'd make it. We just kept going day after day after day. You know, say, oh my God, what's gone wrong today? What's going to happen now? You know? But yeah, it worked. Sometimes I'd stick a pin in myself and say, is it true? Sorry, is it true? Is it really true this is happening? Well, it must be, because I see it.
It was quite extraordinary, this, but most of us, I think, really enjoyed it, and looking back on it, felt that it had been a wonderful time, and we were very lucky to have worked here. And it was lovely to have seen today all those very young people who feel really quite strongly about it, which I think shows that we, perhaps looking back with nostalgia, aren't just looking back on nostalgia. It really was something very, very special. And I think it must have come over to impress young people so much. And all those little trainee waitresses and things to come and do a stint. It was lovely to take it right down to a baby generation, the age some of us were. Not me, but some of us were when they came. I was trying to catch up with some friends who worked in Hut 6. And it was quite a long hut with a door at either end and little rooms opening off. And I opened the door and said, is anyone there? And it sort of echoed, and there were the rooms, the walls falling to pieces. It was, when you think of all the excitement. But it's been wonderful. Somebody said, where are you going this weekend? What are you going to do? So I said, I was going to Bletchley. I was going into history, I said. Which in a way is right, sort of backwards and forwards. But it has been lovely, and I think the way they've looked after us.
Yes. We sang, we did all sorts of things.
Yes. We made cocoa at night, the night shift to keep us awake. Yes. It was off the ration, you see. Cocoa wasn't.
Yes, cocoa and coffee, yes. We had coffee too, because Shirley Wheelock, do you remember Shirley Wheelock?
No,
she was married to a paratrooper, and she had always had her coffee pre-war from the Kenya Coffee Company, and she organised Kenya Coffee for us all the way to Baker Street.
Do you remember? Mary,
yes, I was just telling.
She hasn't come.
I loved her so much that my third daughter's third name is Mary.
Exactly.
You know, I thought she was
such a nice person.
She was a darling.
Absolutely no side whatsoever.
Absolutely.
I made a delightful group once, and I was washing the coffee cups with her. And I said, where did she come from? She said, well, I was brought up in the bog. And I said, you have no trace of Irish accent. Not realizing she was a daughter of the Earl of Meath. Which was really rather nice.
Just ridiculous.
No, she never said a word.
No, quite knew who anybody was, really.
Yes.
Unless you actually were billeted in the same place, it was very hard to make friends.
You didn't know people. You didn't socialise. Well,
no, because you were shot off in buses and
that's
things.
Right.
You didn't really have a chance to get to know people terribly well unless you were living with them.
Or if you were actually in Bletchley itself, you had a bit of social life.
Yeah.
But if you were out with it, 20 miles away.
You were in your office, and then you were in transport, and then you were in the billet. You know,
yes,
that was it. I did start off in a billet in New Bradwell, absolutely ghastly,
yes.
And there was three of us billeted there. The husband was a lorry driver,
yes.
And blue overalls to work, he got covered in grease, and on Monday nights his blue overalls were washed, and to save the hot water, we had to... We had to have a bath in the blue, greasy water.
That's the same sort of story. Wendy and I had to go in one another's water.
Yeah. So we had to take turns having the Monday night one, first.
Yes. Amazing, isn't it?
And he got most annoyed because we wouldn't sit on his lap. Apparently, the previous wrens there, who had moved out to one of the outstations, one of them was Magda Coon, who was Landis Orksey's granddaughter, I think. And she was quite happy to sit in his lap, and he thought we were very snotty because we weren't prepared to sit on his lap.
Far more independent, like, not into that sort of thing at all.
I mean, for so many years, we weren't allowed to say to anybody what we'd been doing. So that you tended to cling to the friends that were with you and knew what you'd been doing, so that you had a point of contact. And it didn't matter if you let something slip.
Oh, right.
You know, because you see, for 35 years, we weren't allowed to talk at all.
Right.
Did you find your wife?
Well, she's in Hut 6. She's looking at Hut 6, where she used to.
Oh, is she?
Oh, that's interesting. I'm a bit of a romantic. Romance blossoms.
In fact, someone said to me first when I asked that question, how many people were joined up here, and they said, oh, not many, and I met three.
I don't believe that.
I don't believe that. No.
Oh, yes.
Plenty, obviously, well, because there was little...
Of course, there may be a large number of liaisons which were illegitimate.
Oh, God,
not the famous.
Of course.
And there wasn't much here to do, I would believe.
No.
No, you must be substituted. Did you actually
work
in this?
Any more? Would you want to look around any more? Or would you like to go somewhere else now?
Well, I don't suppose that this other little block, which had the first bomb, I don't suppose that's open.
That six?
Oh, well. No, here.
Oh, that one. There's one that's not open.
I used to play tennis here, rather bad tennis.
There was more than one court, I feel.
I thought there were two courts.
I think I find it hard to remember. And of course there was the maze, and it was only too easy to find your way because it was trodden by the time I went.
You come over to the mansion, you came every day, I think you said, to eat and so on.
Well, originally we fed in the dining room here, but they built a canteen outside. At one stage, there were five sittings for lunch, and each area had to accept about equal numbers for the five sittings. Yeah. Naturally, the 10 past 12 and the 10 to 2 were not very popular sittings. However, I also remember one time when we were working shifts, a night shift, and something came up which we had to finish. Sean Wiley rang up and asked him to keep us something, and when we got to the canteen, they had kept us something, which was potatoes and cheese sauce with potatoes as the vegetable. Well, it was filling.
Filling, yes. But on the whole, I think you said the meals were rather good.
I suppose so. There was behind the stairs, which you could get London as a local call, or perhaps free, perhaps London free, on the tie line. But, and the other thing, apart from business, was to have a bath in the mansion. Yes, oh dear.
Now, I'm really interested to know what you did, perhaps when you had time off in Bletchley Park. I mean, there's a beautiful surroundings, the lake and the house over the way.
No, you didn't come in here unless you... You see, you only came in here on a coach. You didn't meander in. You were brought in by a coach from whatever village you lived in. I don't know what the people in Bletchley did. They presumably walked up and presumably were well known. But we arrived in a coach with all our names listed, and we had got on the coach and been checked by the armed soldier on the coach, and we stopped at the gate, and another guy came on armed and went up and checked all of us again. So there was no question of coming in and having a day off here. You only came here to work.
So you couldn't just wander around the gardens?
No, you didn't wander around. You didn't wander around at all. You worked, and you went home. And your day off, the great thing was when you changed over, particularly from nights until days, because you'd already worked for that day by 9 in the morning, so you had all that day, and then you had a day off, and then you went back onto evening shift always. So you could have a bit of time then, and the great thing was to have a couple of days off and be able to have two nights in London. And I think, as far as I remember, you could pile up to a certain extent your days off. I mean, I think you could miss, when you were in day shift, I think you could work the whole time and then have an extra day off attached to one of your other shifts, you see. And I used to go to London, I think everybody did. So you got a train and you went down to London, there's nowhere else to go.
So what did you do when you went to London?
Oh, well, I have cousins in London. I went to Hammersmith Terrace and I went around London and I went down to stay with people in Bromley. And I was in London during the doodlebugs, and I remember going down to Bromley after they'd had a really bad do of doodlebugs, and the people I went to see, the woman was packing up and taking everyone home, and she had been blown off, taking her children to school, had been blown across the road, and she was taking the children back to Scotland, so I helped her to pack and collect the children. But the doodlebugs were very frightening, and I remember being the dentist at Bromley, and there was a siren went, or a doodlebug siren, I can't remember, yes there were sirens even with doodlebugs.
Yes, there were.
And I remember the dentist immediately whizzed down to the shelter, so I used to whiz down after him, and he forgot to put the lining in my tooth, you know, and it went the filling went straight in, and that night when I came back to work here, I was in agony, and then the next morning I went down and had the tooth taken out. But I went to London. I don't think my parents would be, you asked what my parents thought, I'm jolly sure they didn't particularly like that, but they never said anything to me. And I remember being stuck on the bridge going across to Blackheath. My friend Rona had relatives in Blackheath, and we used to go and stay there, and I remember being stuck on the bridge there during an airing for a long time. But yes, you came to London, and then you had leave. I don't remember how much it was, but I remember going home for a fortnight. I don't know how often that happened. And then you worked the night before, so you got off at 9 a.m. you see, and you went down to the station, you got the train straight up to Scotland, and that was wonderful. But I don't remember spending days off around here very much. I just remember going to London. It's extraordinary, isn't it? But then I had friends who were Wrens and who stayed in a place called Wavendon House. And I used to spend a little bit of time with them, going over and seeing them. I brought my bicycle down to Scotland and I cycled around a little then, but only in the mornings when I was going on shift at 4. I was thinking as I came down to, you didn't know what day of the week it was at all, because days simply didn't matter. I was looking out at the churches wondering if I'd ever gone to a church here, and I don't remember ever going to church. Sundays didn't exist. The canteen was good for a canteen. There were all these vegetables that were extremely good, raw vegetables. I think they must have been quite careful with the nutrition, actually. And I don't remember people being ill. So I think we must have been quite well looked after without realising it as far as the food went. I'm sure we didn't get extra rations because there was very, very little meat and very little cheese. But we obviously kept well somehow or other. And mind you, the air's quite good here. It's not like being in London. It's quite healthy here. Yes, so maybe that helped.
The place was growing so rapidly.
What time was that?
In 1940.
1940.
And they said we needed someone to organise some sort of recreational things, activities, because no one was allowed to leave.
Yes.
And so I came in and did that.
Mm-hmm.
And we started a club, a recreational club, and then I organised all kinds of activities, chess, bridge, fencing, tennis, and the drama group,
right.
And everything. We had so many people here who were brilliant at all kinds of things.
Yes.
And so, you know, someone had to say, we ought to be doing so-and-so, and there was always someone who knew something about it and could start it. And we started, well, of course, that grew and grew, and we were restricted to travel and so forth. Eventually, we were all restricted to stay here over Christmas, and my husband and I organised a tremendous sort of tombola party in here, because because everyone had to stay here over Christmas, and so those that were off duty wanted something to do, and we came in here. We had sideshows and all kinds of things going. It grew to we had a tremendous membership, because, as I say, there was always someone here who was absolutely a champion at it.
At what it was.
And so it wasn't very difficult to get something going.
Mm-hmm. And did you get the equipment? I mean, if you wanted to set up fencing, how did you get a hold of it?
Well, most of them, they were attached to some clubs and so forth. And we were allowed to have a certain amount of money for recreational activities.
Yeah.
I mean, I think from that point of view, from the government point of view, it was run more or less like a army unit. We were allowed to have what an army unit would have, you know, that sort of thing.
Right.
And so...
And you were here how long?
I was here until 1944, when I had twin sons.
Right.
I used to sit in that corner doing my work, and we had security men just in the hall there, and they used to bring me cups of tea while I was pregnant. So I was here until then, and we went out to Wyburn Sands and lived, and my husband carried on here, of course, but I had someone came and took over from me, and we went on until the end of the war.
Right. And where did you live before you moved to Wyburn Sands?
We lived in Ealing in London.
And came up? What, stayed for a certain period of time and went back?
Or? No. Well, my husband was enrolled to come up here, and we came, he came up, and then I worked evacuating children out of London, and I did all that for a long time, until all the children were eventually evacuated. We were doing that, and then I worked on the financial side of that, trying to extract a little bit of money out of all the parents towards their upkeep and so forth. And then I came down here, and I was free for a short while, and then they asked me if I would come and start this club. And
so house that you had in Wyburn Sands, you came to when you came up?
Yes, it's a tiny cottage. Right. It was built in 1500, just up the hill by the church.
Oh, yes.
Yes. And I came down here, and then my age group came up for recruitment.
Yes.
So I had to go to London, and they said, well, if you're here doing this job, that's fine. So yes. I had to go to London and sign the Official Secrets Act, and then I came back, and that was my core job.
Right.
Yes.
Did you get to know local people when you were here, or was
Yes, we did. When we were working, because we're working all the time and being on shifts,
yes.
I mean, I didn't get integrated into what I would call village society,
mm-hmm.
but there wasn't that much going on. I was going to have them in London, in Ealing, and my mother's house and the nursing home I was going into were bombed on the same night. And so I was living down here in this cottage, and my father rang up and he said, well, you can't come to London, you'll have to have your baby down there. So we saw this doctor in Aspergillus, and he sent me to High Wycombe Hospital, and I had an x-ray, and they told me it was twins. And so we came back, and then we had the, I was saying about the boys born in
That's right. And the only comment we had here was, good old Reg, do anything for a laugh, but at least it's not a cheap one this time. Donnie,
we have to go?
Yes.
Right.
Yeah, thank you very much.
That was Mrs. Parker.
Jane, you were saying that there were occasions when you were just able to escape from Bletchley to to meet the Colonel, I take it.
Well, we used to work 2 weeks, you see, on various ships. One was 4 till 12. You do that for 2 weeks. Then you take some leave, you see, and you come back probably to work on the midnight till 9. And although we called it midnight to 9, that took in breakfast. But the other people came in usually 8 till 4. And then there were other people who worked on the 10 to 6 shift.
I was working at Ministry of Defence in London, and when Jane was on the ship, when she could catch a train down to London, we used to have a couple of wonderful days there.
Oh, yes.
You know, staying with nothing but the best hotels. And then off she'd go back. Well, we went for the bombing somewhere else. We were in one well-known restaurant where the bombs started coming, and they cleared us out. And we all went down below to the cellar and continued the waiters brought the champagne down.
Yes, we had
It was in the Haymarket, in all the Hungaria. And as we came out, we saw the dreadful sight of London ablaze after the bombing. And then Jane having to catch a midnight or 1 o'clock train back in the morning.
Were there any other practical jokes played on people in the huts, or was it all serious all the time?
It wasn't serious at all. It was the absolute opposite. I don't think my chief memory of the whole place was that it was hilariously funny. Yeah. We laughed all the time, really. I mean, it sounds insane, but it was very amusing.
Do you think that was because of the pressure that you were under, that it was just a let out for you?
Well, I think the main thing about it was that there was a total absence of any rules or red tape or anything. It was astonishing. I mean, you came and went and so forth. There was absolutely no discipline at all. Everybody worked their guts out. So
everybody
worked
called everyone by their Christian name. Yes. You know, it doesn't matter who they were.
That strikes me as quite funny that there was no discipline, yet the place was shrouded in secrecy.
Well, everybody was very, as it were, seized of the importance of the thing, very conscious of it.
We were all very careful not to mention. I mean, we all signed the Official Secrets Act, and of course, we never said anything outside.
But you never asked people in the place, you know, in another block. If one didn't know what they would never ask them at all. You just, you know, it was amazing security, actually. It was, but it was very funny, the whole thing. When I arrived here, there were lots of girls, and they were all incredibly attractive. And I was told that Stuart had said that, okay, he wanted a lot of girls, but he was only interested in the pretty ones. And the one thought, you know, joke. And after the war, I met the old battle axe, who, in fact, had interviewed me in London. And I said, this rumour had it that this was the main question when we interviewed. My dad said, perfectly right. This is not England going to war.
All the English roses in Bletchley Park.
It was a very high standard.
Yes, it was a high standard. standard.
Dorothy Heisen and all sorts of people. They looked like the Folies Bergère.
One lady has said it was full of Debs who knew nothing.
Yes, it's about it, yes. But we're not stupid, in point of fact.
No, I don't know if it's full of Debs. I think that's exaggeration. Well, our part wasn't full of Debs.
Well, quite a lot had it.
Yes. Were you aware of certain people being, you know, risque or, you know...
Do you mean from a security point of view?
Yeah, I mean, did you ever think, possibly that could be a security leak or...
No, I don't think so at all. I think...
The security was a joke because we all had passes and we were all supposed to show them as we came through in the bus or whatever it was. And, you know, you idly waved a letter you were reading at the chap. I mean... In fact, everybody knew everybody. So, not remotely conscious of security at all, really. We put on a very good kind of act for night shift. You know, we'd say night, but it takes a very boring sleep.
We used to get off in here, in the summer, so we had to have it all blacked out. So they used to put boards on here, and there was just no air at all.
So you were working in pretty awful conditions.
Well, it was,
really.
It was in the summer.
In the summer,
night.
It was difficult.
It was really
because
awful.
Because of all this blackout. Yeah. They never came anywhere near us. I mean, they dropped through bombs by mistake somewhere out of
So you weren't conscious of being a target at any time?
No, not at all.
We weren't. It wasn't a bit like that, was it?
No.
It was quite extraordinary.
No, you didn't really have any feeling. I mean, I'm sure people nowadays don't understand that we weren't really in fear of our lives or anything
not
at all.
Can you tell me where you were actually billeted then?
Naspy Guys, in the rectory there.
Princely Sam, the Guinea Week.
Yes.
Yeah, so everyone seems to say it's the Guinea Week.
Yes, no, everybody was charged. We were paid 5 guineas altogether, weren't we?
£4
I think it came to £5 anyway. And you had plenty of money. That was a funny thing.
So what did you do in your spare time then? I mean, when you weren't on shift.
Slept. We went away,
you see, for your... I think you had 2 days at the end of every fortnight.
Yes, we worked fortnightly shifts. Days
and then
was 9 to 4.
Days off.
4 to 12, 12 to 12.
And I used to usually go to home or go to stay with somebody. But I must say, on the night shift, I used to go sometimes out for the day up to London or to Oxford or Cambridge and then come back and work the next night.
Were you ever late for your shifts?
No.
Well, you couldn't be, really, because you caught transport.
Right.
We were an enormous network of transport. But you could at least, I mean, if you were on the 9-4 shift, you could stay and go out on the 6 o'clock transport and things like that. Always. We used to go to Northampton to the theatre. Just get back in time for midnight transport.
What about locally? You obviously, you've heard about the musical society and the drama.
Oh, drama.
Were you involved in those?
Production secretary for some of the plays. Because there were a lot of actors and actresses. I mean, a lot of everybody, really, if you look around.
So you were very mixed crowd.
Very, yes. Lots of talent. It was an extraordinary performance.
Because we had Dorothy Heisen, who then married Anthony Quayle. You know, she was in the registration room.
Well, yes, there was Ambrosine Philpott.
Yes, Ambrosine Philpott was there.
So how would this room be set up, with sort of like easy chairs or, you know, a few tables?
Or wooden tables and chairs, fairly upright, I think. I think about one or two sofas around the edge, but I think my vague impression was
wooden tables. So it was a general relaxation room?
Yes, it was like a sort of canteen.
And what was the atmosphere in here like? I mean, was there music or...?
No. Just noise.
Normal chat.
Chat, yes, yes.
So what did you chat about?
You know,
anything but work?
Never talk about work.
What anybody says.
Whatever was going on or something.
What you've been doing?
Well, I wasn't here for very long because you only had 3/4 hour or an hour for a meal or whatever. So just rushed in, grabbed a cup of coffee and went, rather, I think. But obviously it wasn't anything like as clean and tidy as this. This is fairly ramshackle, I think, as far as I can remember.
Were you actually allowed free access to everywhere in the house, or
were there certain rooms? There were no barriers, but when there was no necessity, unless you were working, you just came and used the, I think it was a club or something, I don't know whether it was a club, I think it was a sort of club, and one just came in, had coffee and went out again. We didn't stray about. Mm. No, it didn't stray about, actually. This is why one gets so confused now, because we just went away, we were going to work. I mean, in the summer, you sat about by the lake or whatever, but we had awfully little time when you weren't either rushing to arrive or rushing to leave, or rushing to the cafeteria.
Can I ask you, do you remember where we had meals? Like on night shift, for example, you always had supper about 2.
Cafeteria.
Yes, but before outside the cafeteria was built.
Very good point. In the house.
Yes, in here, yes, somewhere, but yeah. Where? When was the cafeteria built?
It must have been done. It was built just. It had been open a week when I got here.
Which was when?
May 42.
Well, you see, I came June 41, and the cafeteria wasn't built then. Now, where did we have meals?
Yeah, I know you went to the house, everybody said.
What? No, we didn't. That was a new one. You see, I can't find anyone. Why were we so blank? They must have been off.
It was in the house. Well, we are in the house.
Yes, but was it? Did we not eat in the house?
Yes, but you tell me where. You see, well, all of us are standing
right. Upstairs?
We don't remember a thing about it.
Well, perhaps you ate here, which afterwards came the coffee.
You can't. I cannot remember things.
I don't remember going upstairs, do you?
No, neither do I.
I think we must have
gone down here. I think
we used these two rooms, but I can total blank on memory.
Perhaps that was one of the reasons why they kept us well scattered, so that it didn't look as though quite so many people were here. But it is extraordinary, indeed it's extraordinary, that there are people never found out.
I was just staggered as I was reading through it.
Yes.
Because, you know, somebody must have talked to relations or friends or...
Well, I don't know.
When you think of close relationships that people have, I mean, I can't believe that nobody didn't tell their wife or their...
I don't know. I think the atmosphere in war was so absolutely different. It really was. I mean, after all, every time you went on a train, you saw a notice up about, is your journey really necessary? And I do remember going into places where you could have a drink of hot milk and chocolate or something or other, and there was a great thing up, food costs lives. I mean, I remember these food costs lives very, very strongly. I think one was terribly aware of people being killed. After all, one had to hear how many of the bombers didn't return every morning and things. I remember going up onto some highish ground here and watching the American bombers going out. It was a terrible thing, you know, because you were longing for the war to end, but you knew what these bombers were going to do. And then you heard the planes going out at night too. I think one was so aware of people being killed. I certainly was so aware of people being killed. And I think you just didn't do these things.
Must have been great to hear that the war had ended.
Oh, it was absolutely wonderful, yes.
What did you do?
I happened to have 2 days off and I got up to London and I met a friend of mine who was a nurse at the emergency hospital in Birmingham. She came down and we met and we went up Whitehall and we saw Churchill coming out on the balcony. Oh, it was absolutely wonderful. The crowd was absolutely thick, you know, you couldn't move. And people were just in tears. And then he came driving round and we were on the road when he came driving round in the open car. Oh, it was absolutely wonderful. Great to be in London from every point of view. Great, because nowhere else knew what it was like. Oh, yes, it was wonderful.
Because they had such a rough time, didn't they, during the war?
Yes, yes, yes. Terrible, terrific guts.
And yet you still went down to London during your break time.
I think one almost felt obliged to, actually. Again, it's part of the business that other people were living there the whole time, you know.
And they didn't call you up in time. I didn't want to come here at all, so I took firm effort and became aware. And I arrived at the amnesty when I was 17 and a half, said, right, you know, wars as good as ever, here I am. And then they took me to go away. Every young female of that age in the world wants to join the WAF. So they enrolled me and gave me a medical and said, go away and wait. I was so angry, so deflated. And then the following weekend, I met yet another person who said, you ought to go to Bletchley. He said, right, maybe you promise me you'll write.
It's interesting, you see, because a lot of people, obviously, nobody'd heard of Bletchley amongst the people I knew at all. They all said, where are you going? I said, well, I don't know, somewhere in the sort of lower Midlands. You know, I'm such a southerner that wogs start at Watford, you know, anyway. And so, it's terrible. And I wasn't quite sure where Bletchley was myself. one of the reasons why I came here.
I was told where it was somewhere in the South Midlands.
I was told. You see, when I thought, realised it was really hardly outside London, poor dear.
Well, I knew somebody here. So she put my name forward, and one of the reasons I came here, it's on the North Line. Mm. And not all trains stopped at Bletchley, but if you were lucky, you got in at Perth and you got out at Bletchley. And the ones that didn't always slowed down. And the number of times I thought, shall I jump? I never did. But they used to slow down and then they'd go up. You had to go all the way into London and all the way out to get on one that stopped. But that was one of the reasons, because I knew I could get to and fro from home, which was Aberdeenshire.
I can remember the bus stop from Piccadilly to come back to Euston, Bletchley, late, if you were on at midnight, so you would be in London till the last minute. And I was when the end of Shaftesbury Avenue was the bus stop. And I was wandering up and down, doing nothing, and a woman came up and she hissed in my ear, "Get off my beat!" First of all, I wondered how I was dressed, you know. And secondly, one was shattered. And I thought, I can't get off her flaming beat because I want this bus. One of my best wartime stories, I think. But he'd rather put one off then. You know, you felt you must go somewhere else to catch a bus. What's its number? I can see it now, straight to Euston. And if you could time it exactly for the last... Was it 19?
There were all sorts of talents. And there was a very fine opera group, and they did Dido and Aeneas. And then in one of the reviews, I had a song to sing, "Don't Tell My Mother I'm half of a horse in Dido, for that would break my mother's heart. She knows I'm on the stage, she thinks that I'm the rage, and that I always play a leading part. So, but if in due course she finds out I'm a horse in Dido, don't tell her which half I am."
One of the ladies, she's got three of the review programs.
Oh, really?
Yes. Which one was it? Joan Pryman.
Oh, gosh, I've got some of them at home.
Yeah.
I've even got...
I'm very glad you broke into
At least cut out, if not full, but I think that had extracts from the Bletchley Gazette. Is it the Gazette? I think it was. Local newspaper.
Yes.
And they were not, for security reasons, allowed to quote any names.
Well, all the later on these programmes.
This is typical, isn't it? Yeah. You can't put them in the newspaper, but you can buy a programme. Yeah. Yeah, this is where we used to feed right at the beginning in the early night in 1940. We came in for lunch. You know, we had tablecloths and knives and forks and all that stuff. And then I think it must have been back end of 41 into 42, the canteen cafeteria was built just outside the gate. So, of course, you had to show your pass to get out and gate and go in and have lunch and then come back again. Why they couldn't have put the fence around there, I don't know.
Yes.
And then, of course, they put up what is now Wilton Hall, which officially went up as a recreation hall governed by the number of hostels that the accommodation was down there. In fact, I don't know if it's still got it, I suppose it has. It's got a sprung dance floor and all sorts of things. I don't know whether it still has, but I imagine it has. Yeah. But that was, the money came for the recreational hall for the people living in the thing, you see.
That's interesting.
Yes.
The whole billeting thing, I mean, did people mind being billeted? Or is that part of it?
I was lucky. Beechcroft Avenue, I was happy the minute
you could change your billet if you absolutely needed.
I had a lovely time. I think exceptional. In the end, I was all right. The idea was to sit on the billeting officer's knee, and then he found rather better billet. But he may be fast, so you better cross that one off.
This is absolutely true.
Next month, we'll bring you more from the party that saved Bletchley Park. We'll share some of the insights into what life was like, looking both inside and out the gates of Bletchley Park. Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and Catherine White and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, don't be shy. Write us a ripping review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.